Hello, I'm Amy Walter. This is the Odd Years, the Listener Mailbag Edition. We here at the Cook Political Report started this special series for 2024. We know you have many questions about races, politics, polls, and we're here to answer them. Today, I'm passing the mailbag baton. Is there a mailbag baton? I don't know, but whatever. Or maybe even just a mailbag itself. Off to my colleagues, David Wasserman, Jessica Taylor, and Aaron Covey. And don't forget, you too can call and ask us a question. Just call up this number, 202-739-8520. Press 8, say your name, where you're calling from, and maybe your question will make it onto the air.
Hey, Jess. Hey, Aaron.
Hey, Dave.
Hello.
So we've got some great questions today, and I'm feeling a little spicy. I don't know about you guys. So let's start with the one that I think is on many minds this week after Trump's conviction. Susan in Virginia asks, can you talk about Trump's conviction and what it might mean, not just for the presidential race, but for other Republicans running in 2024? And, you know, the down ballot aspect of this is something that we've gotten a number of questions about since late last week. And just off the top here, it's fascinating to me to see not just the reactions from the predictable red state Republicans about lawfare and what they claim is the weaponization of the Justice Department, but the reactions from swing district Republicans. And then on the other side of the spectrum, you have people like Larry Hogan who are running in a Biden plus 30 state. He's just about the only one in a race that we're following who has said that the verdict should be respected. But Aaron and Jess, what are you noticing about Republican responses to this verdict? Jess, first to you.
The first Senate candidate that came out with an ad was Tim Sheehy in Montana, which makes sense. That is the most Republican state that is held by a Democrat that is up a state that Trump won by 16. So it absolutely makes sense that someone like Tim Sheehy wants to hammer home that he's supporting Trump and differentiate that between John Tester. And we also saw the other most Republican state, Ohio. We saw the Republican nominee Bernie Moreno there also come out with a digital ad. So we are largely seeing, even in some of these swing state races, that Republicans are saying that this was a politically motivated prosecution and things. And I think it just shows how much fealty they still have to Donald Trump. But you mentioned Larry Hogan. That's the one that's fascinating to me because, I mean, Hogan just dared in the hours after the Trump verdict to say that the court should be respected and the jury's verdict should be respected. And you had, Chris LaCivita, co-chair of Trump's campaign and at the RNC now, essentially saying, like, your campaign's over. And you had Trump's daughter-in-law and RNC co-chair, Laura Trump, go on bashing him about his response. I mean, that's honestly the best thing Larry Hogan could ask for right now, as he's trying to differentiate himself from his party. You know, all of his ads so far have been saying, you know, I would be pro-choice, I would codify Roe, and here's where I differ on my party. And here's a place where they're giving him room to differ from his party. When Hogan announced, there was some, I think, question about whether Trump would attack him, given he's been so, you know, anti-Trump and different things. And, you know, the Trump folks around him don't really understand, I think, to a way that he has to take a different tact in a state where he needs to likely outrun Trump by more than 30 points. And so this has given him an opening to make that differentiation. I'm still doubtful it's going to be enough, because if we're just talking about, you know, John Tester needing to outrun Trump by double digits, I think it's even harder still for Larry Hogan to do that by 30 or more points. Biden won the state by 33 points in 2020. But it certainly gives Hogan an opening in a way to sort of be able to run a different type of campaign.
Aaron, what are you noticing on the House side?
Yeah, it's been interesting watching the reaction of vulnerable Republicans, because most of the terrain that the battle for the House is being fought on is in districts that Biden won. So this is obviously a difficult issue for those Republican incumbents to address. But despite that, the majority of Republican incumbents in toss-up and lean R races have put out statements supporting Trump and kind of dismissing the results of the trial as corrupted. And that's been interesting to watch. There have been a couple of Republicans who have not said anything altogether. There was one Republican, Lori Chavez de Remer, in an Oregon swing district who basically pivoted and was like, we should talk about kitchen table issues instead. So, you know, I think this is going to be a really difficult issue for all of these Republicans to navigate, you know, maybe for the ones that are in districts that are more evenly divided or ones that Trump narrowly won, it'll be a little easier. But for folks like David Valadao and Mike Lawler in districts that Biden won by double digits in 2020, this is going to be, quite frankly, I think a toxic issue for them.
And this is so far from an Access Hollywood situation where we had even Republicans in red-leaning districts criticizing Trump 8 years ago. This seems as if, you know, only Republicans in substantially Biden or blue districts are hedging in what they're saying about this. Second question is from John in Lansdale, Pennsylvania, who asks, and I love these questions that get into the weeds, why do you rate California 41, which is the Riverside County seat held by Republican Congressman Ken Calvert, in a better category for Democrats, we have that in the toss-up category, than California 45, which is an Orange County seat held by Michelle Steele that we have in Lean Republican, considering that Democrats lost California 45 in 2022 by an even smaller margin than the 41st district, and California 45 was a Biden plus six seat in 2020, whereas California 41 was a Trump plus one seat in 2020. Okay, I have my own thoughts on this, but I'm going to defer to Aaron, who's actually covering this race at a granular level.
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I love these really specific questions too. I think this is where it comes down to the fact that we are not just looking at data here at the Cook Political Report. We're also thinking about candidate quality and looking at, we're looking at numbers and their fundraising, and we're looking at current polling for this cycle. We're looking at how they performed relative to other Republicans and Democrats in their districts. And so, you know, I think this is one case where Democrats have a really strong challenger in Will Rollins, who overperformed Trump's margin, or excuse me, overperformed Biden's margin in the district in 2022 without much outside support. And so that's why I think Democrats are particularly bullish on him. He has outraised Ken Calvert. Calvert also has a pretty long conservative record that is probably out of step with this district now that it's a lot more purple. And so I think that's why we have this in a better category. Whereas on the flip side, Michelle Steele has been one of the Republicans who has proven that she can really outrun Trump and do well in these Biden districts in previous cycles. And, you know, she has done, her campaign has run a really strong operation reaching out to a lot of the voters in this district. It's a super diverse district, has a lot of various Asian American populations there that require, you know, like a tight campaign to be executed. Her campaign pulled this off last cycle. And so I think for all of those reasons, that's why we believe that the 41st is going to be more competitive at this point.
Yeah, great points. And I would add on top of that, that we're not just looking at the baseline presidential numbers and the baseline congressional numbers, but also the trend line in each district. Anything touching Palm Springs right now is fairly toxic and has a lot of downside potential for Republicans, given how many new arrivals there are to that area of Riverside County, bringing their political values from elsewhere. We noticed that yes, even though this district did vote for Trump by a point in 2020, that was well down from Trump's 7-point margin, I believe, there in 2016. Whereas looking at the Asian plurality 45th district in Orange County, this is actually a place where Trump made strides between 16 and 20. Hillary Clinton carried that seat, I believe, by a dozen points in 2016. Joe Biden only carried it by 6 points in 2020. And as you mentioned, Will Rollins is putting together a stronger campaign and more money than Derek Tran against Michelle Steele. And Steele has less of a record to defend than Calvert, who's been there for over three decades. Great question, John. All right, Justin asks, Trump claims that he can put Virginia and Minnesota in play. Regardless, can the Senate races in those states be competitive? And Jess, I know this might not be the most pressing question we're paying attention to, but any thoughts on those contests?
Yeah, Trump has put out some of his own polling. We have seen some surveys that show both races closer. Of course, Trump won, Biden won Virginia by 10. I mean, I think if we're looking at this, if these numbers are real, which I think we have a lot of skepticism about, then we're not even talking about, you know, the other swing states being in play. I think if Trump were to somehow win Minnesota or Virginia, we're talking about a huge electoral rout at this point. But we have seen in other polling, and I certainly think it's true of these two Democratic incumbents, Tim Kaine in Virginia and Amy Klobuchar in Minnesota, that they have the ability to outrun wherever Biden is, and I think they will. You know, Kaine has been there, was former Virginia governor, very much sort of in the more moderate tradition of Virginia governors, along there with his seatmate, another former governor, Mark Warner. He was vice presidential nominee. I think he starts out at a very clearly a big, strong spot. In 2 weeks, we have the Virginia Senate primary there. There's not been a lot of polling or really any on it. I think Hung Cao, who ran last cycle in Virginia's 10th district, is probably the front runner there. He has the most money. He just received Donald Trump's endorsement. The other two main candidates to watch are former Club for Growth executive Scott Parkinson, and then I have heard some rumblings about Eddie Garcia, who's a Northern Virginia resident as well, could appeal to some Latino voters, but I think this is going to be a very, very low turnout primary with virtually nothing else on the ballot except for some congressional and local races and different things. So, you know, I think Cao has the military background, but he's also said a lot of controversial things. Ultimately, in both places, Republicans have much better chances in so many other races. Minnesota is a little bit of a pickle right now because you have the state party that has endorsed a former NBA player, Royce White, who did run for Congress in 2022, had a lot of questionable spending after he lost, including at strip clubs. He has a history of not paying child support, of assault allegations and different things. Republicans would much more prefer Joe Frazier there, who is a Navy veteran. He has said that he will run against against White in the primary now. And I think it also sort of continues a trend of what we see a certainly a more conservative MAGA-esque primary happening at conventions. We saw this in Utah. Also when, you know, candidates for Senate and for governor were not the mainstream Republican candidates and things too, that those dry far more conservative part of the electorate, and that's not necessarily nominating who might be the strongest candidate. But, you know, if we're talking in a couple of months about Virginia and Minnesota in play at either the presidential or the Senate level, we're not even talking about, like I said, we're talking about an electoral route, and we're talking about maybe Senate Republicans getting up to 56 seats.
Yeah, these do seem like seats 57 and 58, perhaps. And it can't be overstated that part of the reason why some polls are showing these states to be relatively close to the presidential level is Joe Biden, whereas Tim Kaine and Amy Klobuchar still retain stronger favorability and popularity. Okay, next question is, if you had to pick one or several congressional districts that serve as barometers for the country as a whole, and I'm looking at you, Aaron, which would you say are worth watching?
There's so many. And I think depending on the dynamic you want to look at, you can pull out a lot of different examples. But as far as good barometers, I think Michigan's 7th district in Lansing, Michigan would be a good one to look at. This is a seat that Biden narrowly won in 2020, so it could honestly go either way at the presidential level in 2024. And it's one that's left open now that Alyssa Slotkin, one of Democrats' strongest incumbents, is running for Senate there. So I think this is a pretty evenly divided playing field that the two candidates are operating on. Republicans have a repeat candidate in Tom Barrett, who is an Army veteran, a former state senator, and then Democrats have Curtis Hertel, who is a former state senator who most recently worked for Governor Whitmer. I think these are both probably two relatively generic candidates. I think both parties feel satisfied with their nominees here, but I think this will be one that, you know, if Democrats are able to hold this seat, that bodes pretty well for their odds of taking back control of the House. But if Republicans can flip this seat, that bodes well for their odds of keeping it. But there's so many others, Dave. I would love to hear your default.
Well, that was number one on my list. So great minds think alike. There are a couple others in our toss-up column that stand out to me. Colorado's 8th district is fascinating. Yadira Caraveo. It's likely Republicans are going to nominate Gabe Evans, who's a young Hispanic state legislator. And this seat is both suburban, but it also has a blue collar component to it, a significant Hispanic vote. And even though it has trended towards Democrats in past presidential elections, if Donald Trump performs better with Hispanic voters, particularly Hispanic men, this could be a better opportunity for Republicans. And it is a must-hold seat, in my view, for Democrats to be able to make a play for the majority. Okay, next question is more in Jessica's lane. What do you make of this reverse coattails phenomenon of Biden polling behind the Senate candidates in key races, for example, Montana, Ohio, Arizona, and Pennsylvania? Is this more of an issue of the Senate Republicans not being as well defined as the Democratic incumbents? And so would we expect the polling to narrow as we close in on the election? Or do we think it's more of a response to Biden's unpopularity and something that may persist through the cycle? Ooh, that's a long question. And I have to say up front, I'm not sure I love the term reverse coattails. I think that implies something that may not be happening when we look at the differential in polling between the top of the ticket and the Senate contests. But Jessica, what light can you shed on this question?
I'm with you there on this idea of reverse coattails. I think it's something that's sort of gotten buzzy on the internet. But to me, it's really whether these Senate Democrats can outrun Biden. And if we look at recent history, that has not been the case. They've outrun him some, but in 2016, every single Senate race went the same way as a presidential result in that state. And in 2020, only Susan Collins of Maine managed to outperform Trump by about 7 or 8 points in Maine there. And of course, she, I think, is a uniquely independent senator in sort of the same way that John Tester in Montana and Sherrod Brown are. But we have to look, these are much wider gaps. Again, Montana, the state that Trump carried by 16, and Trump won Ohio twice by 8 points. So I don't think there's any question that Sherrod Brown and John Tester are going to outrun Biden. These are in two states that the Democratic presidential campaign is not going to play in. But can they outrun him by enough is the question. And when we look at those other states like Arizona and Pennsylvania, and I would also put, you know, Michigan in that category and Wisconsin, you know, we released last week, of course, our swing state project polling with GS Strategies and BSG. And we did, you know, and you can read more about this on our website, Amy's analysis of this, and find the data in crosstabs if you're a subscriber. But we did see that these Democrats were outperforming things. I think that there are some unique things in each of these races. For instance, in the Arizona open seat, Ruben Gallego is very much outpolling Biden. But I think part of that is a function of that the Republican candidate, Carrie Lake, who was the gubernatorial nominee last cycle, is such a defined candidate that views of her are already very entrenched in voters' minds there in Arizona. And of course, that's a race that we recently moved in Democrats' direction from toss-up to lean Democrat. And that really had more to do with Lake and the type of campaign that she's running. With some of the other candidates, you know, in Nevada or Pennsylvania and Michigan, they're less defined. And I think there's room for them to grow the Republicans. And just the question is, can Democrats keep outrunning Biden by these margins? I would not be surprised to see this narrow. Again, when we look at history, we have to see that that is a phenomenon, that it's just the decrease in ticket splitting. Or is this election going to be more of an aberration where we do see that voters are consciously splitting their tickets, perhaps because they do want a check and balance? That is what a lot of our data suggests. For instance, when we talked with the pollsters, they did say that, you know, particularly the issue of abortion is one that is working in Democrats' favor at Senate races versus it's not having as much of an impact on the presidential vote. We see Democratic candidates try to differentiate themselves from Biden, particularly on the two most pressing issues, especially in border states like Arizona, on immigration. And I mean, a lot of these Democrats have released ads touting some of their work with the Trump administration. Tammy Baldwin in Wisconsin, her first ad was talking about, you know, passing a law that infrastructure projects have to be made with U.S. Steel, and showing President Trump signing it into law. So they are touting sort of their bipartisan approach, and in many ways trying to separate themselves from Biden in their states. But, you know, again, the past two cycles show us that those votes go so much in tandem. But because this is such a unique election cycle with a former president and a current president that are at historic levels of dislike by voters, we could see possibly that streak break somewhat.
Aaron, any closing thoughts on the relationship between the presidential vote and the House on this reverse coattails question, which I think we all agree is probably not the right thing to call this dynamic?
Yeah, no, I don't think it's a question of these down ballot Democrats pulling up Biden. It's a question of whether they can outrun Biden, which I do think a lot of House Democrats who are in the competitive districts this cycle have the potential to do. They've proven that they can do it in a midterm cycle. Now, that's not the same because Biden wasn't on the ballot then. But, you know, I think that they do have a bit of, some of these Democrats do have a track record of outperforming Biden, folks like Jared Golden and Marcy Kaptur, definitely in Ohio and in Maine. But there are also, as a rule, I would say, House Democrats are definitely polling better than Biden right now. So he's not helping things, but he may not be a death knell for all of them.
Well, Jess and Aaron, thanks so much for answering these questions. And for all of our listeners, please keep the questions coming. Go to cookpolitical.com/mailbag or call us. I love this. You can call in at 202-739-8520 and press 8. I promise it's going to end up being much more satisfying and educational than dialing a psychic hotline. Say your name and where you're calling from. The Odd Years is brought to you by the Cook Political Report team. And if you'd like to explore more of what we have to offer, including our podcast, The Editor's Roundtable, consider subscribing at cookpolitical.com/subscribe. Odd Years listeners can use the discount code OD10 to save 10% on any subscription. And this offer is available only to new subscribers. The Odd Years is produced by Becca Kaufman and Allie Flynn, who are the real superstars of this operation. Thanks, and talk to you next time.